Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode 196 of Getting It Out Podcast. That was Pleasant Living with Father's Day off of their 2013 demo, which later became a 7-inch on A389 Records. And the guy that you heard singing in that song, that was me. That's the big surprise. That's the big reveal. The truth is, I was listening to that 7-inch earlier today, well, on Spotify in my car. Oh, by the way, I don't mean to brag, but that's been on Spotify for about 8 years, and one of the songs is over 1,500 plays. So yeah, I mean, not to big time you, but we're a pretty big deal at this point. The rest are still in that negative, not negative, but under 1,000 area where you don't get a number. It just tells you it hasn't hit 1,000 yet, and I think that's pretty funny. But I was just listening to it earlier, and I thought, you know what? I'm sharing that again. I haven't done that in a while. So there it is. That was my band from 2013. And if you want a 7-inch, I still have several of them. I'll forever feel bad for Dom at A389 for spending the money to put this thing out, but I'm always going to be thankful that he did. It's a cool thing to have, whether it went over well or not. Okay, anyway, speaking of things that do go over well, on this episode, I've got an interview with Mike Musilli of Long Island's Become One. Earlier this year, they released a record on New Morality Zine called Subsidence. And we're going to talk all about that in Long Island and all sorts of other things, and you're going to love it. So let's do it.
Kick it! Make family out of friends, make friends out of enemies! Peace to my family, make friends till they bury me. All the places we've been, we're never sitting it out. We be getting it in, where you getting it out? I said all the places we've been, we're never sitting it out. We'll be getting it in, where you getting it out?
Okay, so I just made a mistake. It's a mistake you're all familiar with, I'm sure. It's a common mistake that billions of people have made over the years. I got McDonald's for dinner. I was in South Philadelphia. I had a long drive ahead of me. I figured, better eat now. And there's only a couple spots I can stop before I get on the turnpike or before I get on 76 and the turnpike. There's just nowhere to stop between there and home, basically. And it's an almost 2-hour drive, so I thought, I'll get something. I went to tell you the truth, I tried to go to Wendy's first. There's a Wendy's right there off of Columbus Avenue in Philadelphia. And it's across, or it's in the same area as like an IKEA and such, you know, so I'm going to consider that upscale. To be truthful, Wendy's has just sold me with their commercials lately on how they have new and improved French fries. That's enough. If I'm going to go get some fast food, which I very rarely do, I'm going to try these new French fries, because who doesn't love French fries? So I tried to. I went to the Wendy's drive-thru, I pulled into the drive-thru, and I sat at the speaker, and nothing happened. Nothing at all. I just sat there. And me, just being the type of guy I am, very passive in some situations, I continued to sit there. And then eventually I thought, something's wrong. I'm going to do a loop. So I did a loop. I drove past the inside of the Wendy's and I could see they were definitely open. People were being served. So I went around again and there was now a car in front of me in the drive-thru. And they pulled up and somebody answered them at the drive-thru box and they said, "You got to come inside." So me being how I am, I'm not going inside. All right. I think that's the opposite of what we're supposed to be doing right now. I think the drive-thru is the preferred method. Looked like a new place. I don't know what the problem was, but I wasn't sticking around for it. I knew there was a McDonald's down the street, so I got out of there and went there. That's a mistake. We all know it's a mistake when we do it. We know it's not going to go over well, but we try sometimes. The weaker ones, like myself, we try. I pulled up to McDonald's. I said, "I'll have a double cheeseburger with no pickle." That's standard. No pickle should be the way the sandwiches are served, I would prefer. So I say that, and I say, I'll take a medium fry. And then, you know what? I'll have a milkshake, too, a vanilla milkshake. Because here's the problem. If I get a soda, that's it. First of all, I don't like soda that much. If I have a soda at home, oftentimes I'll go for a Coca-Cola. I'll take two sips out of it, and then I go and dump it down the drain. That's true. That's very true. I don't like the way soda makes me feel. I think I'm gonna. Sometimes I'll have a root beer, and I do like the way it tastes, but immediately afterwards, I feel terrible. So I know I'm gonna feel probably about the same if I have a vanilla milkshake, but I'm gonna really enjoy the milkshake. So that's my trade-off there. Like, well, I could force my way through a soda that I'm probably not gonna like very much, and I'll just suck it down because there's so much sugar in it, and I'm a sugar freak, and won't be able to stop myself. Or I could have this delicious, whatever is in McDonald's milkshakes, and enjoy that and still feel relatively the same. So I did. And I got to tell you, it went as bad as I anticipated. I feel like shit now. I feel terrible because I ate that crap. It doesn't matter how many miles I ran today. I'm going to need to run at least 20 miles this week to reverse what that meal just did to me. I'm a little sad about it, but it's okay. Because I finally get to share with you this interview I did with Mike of Become One. Now, in full transparency, we did this interview quite a while back. I'm just now getting to revealing it to you. I might not have to tell you that. I don't know if if there's anything that dates it, other than the fact that we were talking very positively about Drew Maxey and Time of Pressure. And since then, since this was recorded, and since I've released it, they not only announced their breakup, but also had two shows and effectively broke up, I think just yesterday. I think that band is over. So we talked a lot about how good they are and how we love that Halfway Down record and the lyrics that Drew penned for it. And that might be the reason why they broke up. They hit their height. How much higher can you go when two guys on a podcast that only a couple people will listen to talk about your band? That's a pretty big height in hardcore, to be honest. That never happened to me in Pleasant Living. I can tell you that for sure. But why don't I play you a song from Become One? A song off of Subsidence. This song is called Arrows Through the Eyes of God. And then listen to my conversation with Mike. Hello.
Yeah, what's up, man? How are you?
Good, how are you?
Oh, no complaints, man.
I don't know if you just saw my last message that it was going to be like 8:05, but I had to finish the QAnon documentary on HBO.
Oh. Fascinating stuff that is, isn't it?
It is. It's very, I mean, I was talking with friends of mine about it the other night, and they get, you know, they're pretty liberal like myself, and they get like upset by this stuff, but it doesn't upset me. Like, it's really funny to me in like the sad way.
I think it's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
You know what I would like to know though is like, so, and I don't, I one thing I won't do is like give traffic to, you know, the 4chan or Reddit message boards that those trolls inhabit. But I wonder, like, when that documentary came out and they purported to have found like the people that really started the QAnon thing, like are the Q believers out there being like, that's definitely not them, that's not what it happened, that, you know what I mean, like,
yeah,
doubling down on denial, you know?
Most likely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a fascinating study of psychology.
Well, I think it's a pretty simple conclusion though, that they're fucking crazy. But whatever, it makes it way more interesting, and it kind of makes me, and I say this with a huge grain of salt, but it kind of makes me miss Donald Trump being president. It was just a lot more exciting than usually, for, you know, in worse ways. But you know, it's just,
oh, I mean, look, there was a lot more to talk about.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
I don't know if I could totally fully say I miss him as president, because he was, you know, I mean, he is an American endgame in and of himself. But I'll agree, I mean, there's hardly all that much to talk about, at least in terms of like American political theater at the moment.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of shit. But anyway, you are in Long Island. Are you from Long Island?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on Long Island. If we're gonna go with the full biological history, I was actually born in Columbia, and then I was adopted by my parents, who are from Queens, and I grew up on Long Island. So I can't say born and raised on Long Island, but I could certainly say raised on Long Island.
Pretty close. But hey, all right. So yeah. You've been there long enough to maybe be able to tell me why you are on Long Island and not in Long Island.
In and on.
Yes. I've asked this plenty of times before, sure. I think. But yeah. It's...
So I think for us, and I think this has to do with sort of the inadequacy of language, we would say you don't stand in an island, you stand on an island, right? Whereas you're in a state, because a state is more nebulous than the actual sort of literal body of land that it is. So we just say, yeah, you're on Long Island. But like, it changes immediately. Like, you're not on Queens, you're in Queens. You're not right. On Manhattan, you're in Manhattan.
Right.
But you're just on Long Island. Yeah.
That's
the best I can offer for that. So I know it's semantic, but that's the best I can do.
That's fair enough. I mean, I don't have any arguments against it. But since you're also in New York, we need to talk a little more geography, and you need to tell me what you consider to be the tri-state area.
The tri-state area. Okay. Well, what I'll tell you what I think the tri-state area is versus what I'd like it to be.
Okay.
I think the tri-state area is New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut.
Ooh.
I would like the tri-state area to be New York, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut. I have a lot of love for the people of New Jersey and the New Jersey hardcore scene, but as a state, I think New Jersey is sort of the armpit of America. You know what I mean?
They don't
trust their citizens to make left turns.
Pump
there's
gas.
A lot of weirdness in there. Yeah. Right, exactly. We can't pump our own gas. It's like, come on, what are you guys doing down there? Enough is enough.
Well, from what I understand, and well, I'll get back to the tri-state thing in a minute, but the pumping gas is a liability issue. That's why their gas is cheaper. From what I'm told, I'm probably wrong, but what I'm told is because the gas is cheaper because they don't have to pay insurance for people pumping their own gas. But I might just be spewing some bullshit facts that I heard sometime when I was a kid. But that
sounds like a New Jersey explanation for it.
Yes, it's very twisted in their favor.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds like, oh, no, we're doing you all a favor, which they kind of are, but at the same time, like, give me the choice. If I want to pump my own goddamn gas, get away from me.
Yeah, but are you supposed to tip those guys? I don't know. I don't get gas enough in New Jersey to know if I'm supposed to tip them.
You know, that's a good point. I actually remember when I first got a car, I would tip at full service stations, even in New York, just because like my father and grandfather would do that. But then I sort of stopped, and you know, it's funny, I don't know if I've ever tipped someone in New Jersey, and frankly that's probably unfortunately because of my bias against New Jersey. Not that any gas station attendant in New Jersey has done anything less than a great job, but yeah,
right.
So you don't tip either?
I don't know. I don't get gas there, I don't think. I went to New Jersey twice this summer, maybe three times, and I don't think I got gas there either time. I don't know. I don't remember. Maybe that's not even, is that even still a thing? I don't know. But I go to like southern New Jersey, like Cape May. I don't know.
Beautiful area.
Yeah. For all the shit talk on New Jersey, and I do it all the time
too.
I do it all the time. But I mean, that's where I went to vacation. It's the only place I went to the beach this year, you know, to New Jersey twice.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. But anyway, but back to the tri-state thing.
Yeah.
I live in Pennsylvania, right? And I lived in Baltimore as well, which, as you might know, is in Maryland. It was, but most people just call it Baltimore.
I do indeed know that it's in Maryland.
Since we're big, yep. Since I'm big.
Inner Harbor.
Yeah, that's right. And both of those states include themselves in a version of the tri-state area, too. And
which would be what? What is this, like a Pennsylvania-Maryland thing?
It'd be like, I think if you're in Maryland, I think you might say you're in the tri-state area, and it would be like Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania.
Or, oh, that's not bad.
Or Pennsylvania thinks we're in it no matter what. Like, it doesn't matter what states you include. It can be Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware. It usually includes New York, though. But it's funny because we can't, like, the fucking tri-state area can't be 9 states, right?
It cannot. No, because then you know what you're actually doing? One, we have a math problem, right? You can't have 9 states in the tri-state area.
That's exactly.
But then
right.
Also, now we're just biting on fucking New England, which is like, what is that, 5 or 6 states just clumped around Massachusetts, you know?
Yeah. That's a very confusing area. Try not to go up there. No, I'm kidding, of course. But anyway, so what my questions about Long Island were getting mm-hmm. to is that Long Island has a very, very well-known, I would say at least, a very well-known punk and hardcore scene and sound even. When did you first start getting involved in that scene?
Sure. So my first like real underground hardcore show on Long Island was in 1995. Went to go see a buff. I would imagine you know this band. Went to go see 25 to Life.
Yes. Yes.
With, went to go see 25 to Life with Tension, Overthrow, and a bunch of other bands at this venue called the Roxy, mm-hmm. Out east on Long Island. And up to that point, really, I was sort of like a punkish 120 Minutes type of kid,
yeah.
Where.
Yeah.
You know, not having a bunch of friends for, you know, 8th, 9th, 10th grade, I just sort of found myself enveloped in music and, you know, sort of picked up bands from, you know, watching 120 Minutes and stuff. And then I went to go see Rancid, The Bouncing Souls, and H2O in Manhattan in, like, late 1994. And I'd seen other, like, you know, punkish shows. I saw Green Day at a huge venue and stuff like that. But the Rancid Bouncing Souls H2O show, for as, you know, corporate as some people might think it was, at that time in late 94, it was still like, I mean, Toby from H2O was walking the line, giving out flyers. Rick to Life was inside giving out flyers, which is actually how I came across the show they were playing with Overthrow, who I ended up being friends with. But so like it was sort of a typical 90s kids trajectory, you know what I
yeah.
mean? You get into the Nirvana grunge thing, realize you kind of like distorted guitars, start vibing on like MTV 120 Minutes, and you know. And you know, it's interesting with sort of like the Long Island sound. Having started going to shows like proper underground hardcore shows in Long Island in '95, you know, the sound was in place, but I think the better part of the Long Island scene was still very much playing little brother to New York hardcore.
Yeah.
And frankly, I mean, it's an impossibly uphill battle. We know that, you know, DC and Cali and New York are these sort of original hotspots of punk and hardcore, but the mythology that follows the New York hardcore scene, it's like being on Long Island, you live in the shadow of that. It's like, you know, it's impossible to almost carve out your own niche. And especially, you know, one of the things that I always thought about, especially when I got really, really into hardcore, it's like, you know, bands like Warzone and Cro-Mags and Agnostic Front and Murphy's Law and Bad Brains I love those bands, but it would be ridiculous of me to say that lyrically I could, especially at 15, 16 years old, that I could relate to like what they were talking about, you know, survival of the streets and street justice and, you know, Last Warning and all that. I was a kid in suburbia. What spoke to me was the sort of thematic violence and anger and unrest of it. But like on a sort of lyrical level, it was like, I'd be faking it if I said like that was a reflection of my life. And I think what really started to happen on Long Island around 1997 was the rise of a band called Silent Majority. Mm-hmm. Now they're not the prototype Long Island hardcore band. You have bands like Crumbsuckers and certainly Mind Over Matter that came before them, but Silent Majority in Long Island, on Long Island, by that time they were the band. It was just the sound that I think made sense for what it meant to be a suburban hardcore kid in our area. The lyrical content reflected the sort of angst and countercultural aspects of hardcore in general, but Silent Majority was telling the story of what it meant to be a suburban hardcore kid mm-hmm. living in the shadows of New York City. And I think when they put out what would really be their only proper full-length, Life of a Spectator, that changed the game on Long Island. That was the line in the sand, the flag was put down, and it was like, yes, we might be New York hardcore's little brother, but we have our fucking sound, we know what our fucking identity is, and we don't have to fucking pretend that we're some streetwise motherfuckers. Silent Majority gave everyone that was to come after that the license to be exactly who we wanted to be. And I think people saw that very quickly. So, I mean, Silent Majority had been around proper if I'm getting my dates right, I think 89 to about 2001. But when you look at what happened on Long Island, 2000 and beyond, you know, brands like Brand New, Taking Back Sunday, The Movie Life, The Reunion Show, bands that got huge, Glastra, those bands don't exist. They do not exist without Silent Majority. And then I think on a more sort of grassroots hardcore level, bands like The Backup Plan, This Is Hell, Crime and Stereo, those bands that sort of at that moment, Thieves and Assassins, that waved more of the Long Island hardcore flag, similarly do not exist without Silent Majority, because they sort of gave that sort of tacit green light to be like, yo, we're fucking suburban hardcore kids. This is what our experience is, and this is what we're rolling with. So it was fascinating to see that too, because also you had bands that emulated the New York hardcore sound, you know, prior to that. You know, VOD doing their thing was a very heavy New York hardcore sound. Neglect, I mean, facsimile of the New York hardcore sound. Tension, a very New York hardcore sound. But Silent Majority was like, all right, so yeah, we're suburban kids that are going to, you know, write songs in our parents' basement about what we know and what our experience is. And I think that when people hear about or talk about now, 25 years later, what the distinct Long Island hardcore sound is, it is very much traceable back to Silent Majority.
Yeah, and of course I can't argue with any of that. I think you sum that up extremely well, and obviously as a person who was there for it, but the for people who might not know what those bands sound like, which I think most people who listen to this would, but it was like, you know, like the bands you mentioned that were from Long Island but kind of played the more New York hardcore, like The Neglect, the VOD, the Tension with the asterisk. That was like
the boy.
that was like the that's the heavier version of Long Island hardcore, right? That's not what people think about when they think about Long Island hardcore. And
no, I don't think so.
Yeah. But
I mean, there's something there now. I think there was a bit of a revival with that. Sort of with like King Nine and Backtrack, and Hangman, you know, who openly sort of cite those bands as influences. So there is something to that. But I think, you know, nationally speaking, generally speaking, I think the vibe is a lot far more melodic, what people expect to come out of Long Island.
Right. So when did you yourself start getting involved with actually playing in hardcore bands?
So playing started somewhat begrudgingly, actually. I mean, I had been more of a kid that sort of took the route of like, I'm going to make zines and book shows. And so from about 17 to about 20, that's really more of what I was focused on. I had some really like, I think maybe I was 16 at the time. I had like a really shitty, are we allowed to curse on this?
Sir? Absolutely. And we already have a bunch. So okay. You're really late with that.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that. No, all right, cool. When I was like 15 or 16, I had like some really shitty zine called Raging Youth Fanzine. And then when I was in college, I had a fanzine, Switchblade fanzine. And I would always book shows and stuff like that. But my best friend, Alex, sort of took the musical route, and he had played in a couple of bands, and then one day showed up at my house with a bass and was like, yo, we're going to start a punk band. You need to learn how to play bass. Here's a bass. Here are a couple of Clash tabs. Figure this out. And that's literally sort of how I started. And I was like, all right, you know, sounds like cool to be in a band. And so he and I played in a band called To Kill For. Which, you know, quite frankly, was a really crappy sort of rancid Millen Collin ripoff band. We were pretty horrible. And it was, you know, it was what you would expect from a bunch of knuckleheads just out of high school.
Yeah.
And right. Exactly. Yeah. But then so like we broke that band up, I want to say around 2000, 2001. And then Alex and I, were headed up to a show. A buddy's band was opening for Murphy's Law in upstate New York, and actually a kid from our town, this kid Christian, also from the Levittown, Wanta area where we all grew up, he happened to be rolling with them too. And so when they were all loading in and sort of doing all their sound check and stuff, the three of us were just sitting in the van, and Alex was like, you know what we gotta do, bro? We gotta like start a political hardcore band. And I was like, yo, that's sick. And then this kid Christian, who we both sort of generally knew, was just like, yo, I'd sing if you guys are down. And so really that was when we formed Crime and Stereo, which would sort of be the band that I think, you know, became more of my musical imprint on Long Island, certainly through like the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And so I did Crime and Stereo with those dudes from about 2001, 2002 to about 2008. So through the first, you know, proper, the first two full lengths, they were gracious enough to give me credit on the third full length. But I didn't really do any touring off that because, you know, I sort of learned the hard way touring wasn't for me. I also sort of learned the hard way that while I really love going to hardcore shows and sort of being on stage, I'm not a very good musician. And as that band, as Crime and Stereo became much better musicians and wanted to expand the sound beyond sort of like a melodic hardcore band, while I wouldn't admit it at the time, I'm happy to admit it now. I just couldn't keep up, man. I just didn't have the chops. I didn't have the chops to keep up. And so like from about 2008 till like 2016, it was really just, I sort of took a back seat to actively playing music and just sort of like going to shows and hanging out and then sort of enjoying it from, I guess, more of like an adult perspective. It's weird, like, you know, being an adult in the real world is not, the math doesn't translate to being an adult in the hardcore scene. I think if like you're 30 or over in the hardcore scene, you are like well into adulthood. Yeah. Whereas like, you know, there are 30-year-olds in the real world that are still like, you know, hardly independent. So right, like, right. You know, when that happened, those sort of 10 years, 2008, 2016 was just like, you know, just gonna, it was a weird moment for me because, you know, a lot of my friends that had gone to shows stopped going to shows, as so many people did. And then my closest friends, like Alex and Christian, were still doing Crime and Stereo, so they weren't around much. And I think one of the interesting things that I just resolved to myself was that, like, if I want to go to a fucking hardcore show, I'm going to go, and I don't care if I go by myself. And that sounds like, that might sound trivial, but, like, that was a real sort of empowering thing that, like, you know, I did it a couple times and basically realized one thing that, like, I love about the hardcore community is, like, you go to a show by yourself, you're not going to hang out by yourself. You go through those doors or whatever the venue is, and there's going to be people there that are happy to see you. And I think that really sort of helped me stay active in hardcore, despite the fact that fewer and fewer of my sort of neighborhood friends were interested in it. But then in 2016, I went to go see my buddy's band Become One, and they had a fill-in bass player, and my buddy Ed, who's the guitarist of that band, who I've been friends with for years, you know, I was kind of fucking with him. I was like, bro, you a little fucking insulting, dude. Like, you know, I know how to play bass. You're not going to fucking ask me to be in the band. And it was a joke, but he was like, wait, are you serious? I was like, yeah, I guess I am serious. And so, you know, after that little conversation, I joined up with Become One and been playing with those dudes since, yeah, around 2016, 2017, maybe.
Right, right. All right. So, hey, yeah. Well, of course, that's who we're going to talk about, the band we're going to talk about here, but I want to backtrack a little bit. I want to say that what I found that I loved about going to shows alone, and I did it a ton when I was a kid, like when I was 16 and nobody I knew liked hardcore and I just went by myself, but and then rediscovered as I was over, you know, into my 30s, mm-hmm. was that the best thing about going to shows alone was just leaving. You can just leave.
Like, it's a very practical thought.
You can just go. Like, there's no waiting around to say goodbye to 300 people. If you don't want to, you can just leave. Because you know how those weird show goodbyes are. That takes forever.
Oh my god, never! It's like trying to leave a fucking wedding. Man.
Yeah, it's
but I gotta tell you, dude. I'll say this, man. I think that's like really resilient of you to go to shows by yourself when you were a teenager. I don't know if I would have had the wherewithal to keep up with that. I think one of the things that made it so easy for me to go to shows as a kid was like I had a pack of friends in high school, a good six or seven of us that would always be wanting to go to shows. And I think if it was just me, I don't know how that would have turned out. So,
well, like I recruited kids, you know, friends of mine that maybe liked punk or something. And I'd be like, "We'll come to this hardcore show," but for the or the ones who also liked nu metal, I'd be like, "Well, come with me to go see Desperate Measures in a park building," you know, like, and that would never work, you know, they never stuck around, but. So I didn't care. I would just go by myself and smoke Swisher Sweet cigarillos between every single band because I was 16 and, you know, like an idiot. Like, I didn't know what I was doing there anyway. But anyway, the other thing I wanted to say is that, like, Crime and Stereo, who I didn't know you were in Crime and Stereo until earlier today when I was just doing my little due diligence research. And I love Crime and Stereo, especially those records that you're talking about being on. And it made me think, when was the first time I saw Crime and Stereo? And I remember it because I remember not knowing who the hell you guys were and just going outside and playing hacky sack in like 2001. So
fair enough. Was it in Wilkes Barre?
No, it was in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. It was at a show called, and I saw the flyer recently. It was called 20 Minute Fest, and it was like it was just in this big gym, and like there was. Bands would play like one after the other, and they would only play for 20 minutes each. And it was like, I don't know who else was on it, like Squirt Gun is like a band I remember being on the flyer.
Oh, okay.
But I think it was probably poorly attended and probably was a shitty show. But that's where I remember Crime and Stereo the first time. And then I saw you guys a shitload, of course, through the 2000s. That Trouble Stateside record, I love. But yeah.
Bro, Pennsylvania was like, you guys showed us a ton of love. I remember like playing Stroudsburg on the demo and then...
Probably played the Champ a lot.
Yeah. But then, I mean, Wilkes Bar was like, the Met Cafe? Was that Wilkes Bar?
Well, that was one of them, yeah. Yeah, they went through quite a few.
That was one of them. Yeah. Bob Mack. Alex Russin, Dan from Cold World, Foster, who's down in Virginia now. Those dudes were like, I think it was Bob Mack who first put us on in like the Wilkes Bar scene, but it was like, dude, we for a good while there, going to Wilkes Bar was better for us than playing Long Island. And it was like,
well, that's like when Wilkes Bar was killing it. That's when they were like the place to be, you know.
Oh, Posse Numbers Fest, I mean, those dudes took care of us, man. And it was like, that was a cool vibe because I think, you know, there was, you know, in the early days of Crime and Stereo, especially leaving Long Island, calling yourself a hardcore band, some states would be like, you guys aren't a fucking hardcore band. You know what I mean? You're not playing fucking heavy breakdown shit. And like, Pennsylvania didn't give a shit about that. You know, like, always a great time in Philly and Wilkes Bar. Even, you know, what's one of the best places that, especially in the early days of Crime and Stereo, we would never miss on a tour? Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. I kid you not, dude, this kid Chad had reached out to us seeing if we could play. He was trying to like set up a show, I want to say like in his high school gymnasium. And like we were just like, you know what, at that point in our lives and at that point of the band, like if we could play it, we were going to fucking play it. Even if it was going to be a money loss, we were just like, fuck it, let's get in the band and do this. And it was such a fascinating thing because like, it clearly wasn't a hardcore scene the way like, you know, Erie has a hardcore scene or Philly does or Wilkes-Barre does. What it was just like the young people of Punxsutawney psyched that a band not from there was going to play.
Yeah.
And it became like, if we were doing a U.S. tour that had us heading west towards Ohio, there's no way we weren't stopping in Punxsutawney to play. I mean, I'm still in, to this day, dude, I still talk to that dude, Chad, that booked us there every once in a while. It was just an amazing guy. But yeah, man.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I've never heard anybody ride for Punxsutawney like that, so.
Fuck yeah, man.
All right, so. So you of course mentioned joining Become One, and as I understand it though, and from doing just the slightest bit of research, Become One was around for quite a while.
Yeah.
What's the history of Become, like the brief history of Become One, and how you got here now?
So the interesting thing about Become One is like they were a band around 97, 98, and so. I met those guys through the singer Sean. He went, there's two high schools in the town that we all grew up in, and he went to the other high school of the one that I went to, but we sort of became friends just because it was like from the same town and we like hardcore, and he had joined this band that at the time was named Standing Eight Count, but they soon changed the name, and then so like it was crazy because from like 98 to about 2001, like not being in a band, I was like, yo, this band is sick. I would, you know, ride out to all the Become One shows when they play Jersey or whatever. I'd roll with them and became super tight with Ed, the guitarist. But they always had a problem. Even back then, they could not keep a bass player. I mean, there were times where I literally watched them play without a bass player. And so they went from about 98 to about 2003-ish and then called it quits. Tried some other iterations with like a couple of members here and there doing stuff, but then they went dormant. And around 2014, I want to say, Sean reached out to the dudes just to see if they wanted to like maybe jam. You know, it had been a good 10 years just to like, you know, play hardcore again. And it just so happened that the bass player that had been with them in the last time they were a band, Matt Wargus, he had actually come down with stage 4 brain cancer. And so the idea of jamming for them became a bit more of an imperative because Matt wanted his young kids to be able to see him play, before he would pass away.
Yeah.
And so it took a bit of a heavier turn, but I think, that happening for them, it went from sort of that lighthearted, let's see what happens with jamming to with what was going on with Matt. I think they sort of perhaps realized, what it is to have music in your life. And so they played a show with Matt playing, and his family came out, and then he unfortunately passed away soon thereafter. And they just sort of, Nevio, Ed, and Sean just were sort of resolved to let's keep doing this. And so they did, and they sort of had a couple fill-ins, a guy that recorded on the 2017 EP. And then I came into the band just as that EP was coming out. And it's like I said, it was really just because I was fucking with my old friend Ed, being like, I'm a bass player and you don't have a bass player, and I'm a little insulted that you didn't invite me in.
Well, it's just a sad story, but any way they handled that would have been, I think it could have, like, I can totally see it saying, all right, we're going to put this thing to bed, but also doing it this way, we're going to carry this on because we realize how important it is. It's cool. I like that. I enjoy that.
Yeah, I think so too. I think there's something inspirational in them doing that.
Right, right. Just keep moving. Yeah. But the when I listen to the two releases from, what is it, like 97 and 2000, maybe?
Yeah.
They sound a lot more like your recent release, The Subsidence.
Yeah.
That record in between, that 2017, that sounds more like what I expect out of Long Island.
Yeah, so that was the band's identity crisis.
Okay.
Transfiction. I think really what sort of happened there was guys had sort of, while they wanted to get back to playing music, what they were actually listening to was sort of no longer reflective of what the band had sounded like a decade before. Mm-hmm. And so some of them were a little bit more into the melodic punk thing. And they decided to take a leap and give that a shot. And I think, I applaud any band that's willing to sort of see, what their musical elasticity is. And I think it's a good EP, but I think one thing that we all learned as a unit from that is we know what sound we are best with.
Yeah.
And Subsidence was a decided move, not necessarily back to a sound, but it was a move to realign ourselves with what every member of that band does well. So you hit the nail on the head. Subsidence certainly is much more aligned with the late 90s, early aughts stuff than Transfiction. Transfiction sort of stands out as the, we don't know what we want to do right now other than release music.
Well, it did. When I listened to it, I checked again to make sure it was the same band, because the way I went through all this was Subsidence first, and then Back to the Beginning, and then I mean? And then came up through from 97, 2000, 2017. By the time I got to that Transfiction, I was genuinely like, oh, what? I guess this is mislabeled, but whatever. Yeah.
You're not the first. You're not the first person to say that. To be like, is that like you guys? What was going on with that? No, but I mean, I think the honest answer really is that they tried to expand the sound in a way that reflected what they were listening to at the moment. And, I respect not trying to stay in the phone booth, and I also respect the idea of learning from the experience.
Yes, yes, and I think it makes it even better that you come out of that and you're able to recapture so well on Subsidence what was done so well on those earlier releases. They didn't lose anything. I think it's better. And to go back, what we were talking about before, it's also a bit heavier than what I expect coming out of Long Island, and maybe not heavier is the word, a bit more aggressive, or at least it sounds that way.
Yeah.
Lyrically, it doesn't. I don't know how much involvement, or if any, you had there lyrically, but it doesn't sound. Mm-hmm. It sounds smart, is what I'm trying to say. It doesn't sound like a hardcore record in that it sounds smart.
We appreciate that. Well, yeah. I mean, so even going back to like the 97 and 2000 demo, even the heavy that was going on Long Island that time, Become One still was a little bit apart from that. I think, Ed, who writes all of the music, I've said this before, and it's just, I think I continue to say it simply because it's true and it gives good context to it. He is, in terms of Long Island, and Long Island guitarists will tell you this, he is one of the best guitarists to come off the island because he does not feel in any way, shape, or form inclined to have to box himself into any sort of song structure, whether it's like, oh, we got to follow, a horse hop riff with a breakdown, or, mm-hmm. We have to have an ambient part. Ed is going to write exactly what comes to him. And I think with Subsidence, he had made a decision coming off the last record that he was going to get gloomier and heavier and more complex than perhaps the band had ever been. And I can tell you this, having only played in Crime and Stereo in terms of recording and like a band that had any sort of catalog, the four songs that he wrote for Subsidence are some of the most complex songs that I've ever had to learn. Because it's just like, there's not a lot of repetition, and it's really like, there's a moodiness to it, and it's I appreciate that you say it's good, and that even lyrically you say it's smart, because I think another thing that we really were conscious of with Subsidence is that, like, we're not going to pretend that we aren't a bunch of 40-something-year-old dudes playing in a hardcore band. We're not, right. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Cat in the Hat lyrics don't work for us. We're not going to talk about being upset by, the friend that stabbed us in the back and all this stuff, because that's not important to us in a way that it perhaps was when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
Sean, our singer, he writes all of the lyrics, but, he is an extremely clever lyricist in that he has a great way with writing songs that people can apply in their own way, but also, in my estimation, really have some really powerful lines to them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think there's a lyrical approach to it that I appreciate, and like the way you talked about how the lyrics you can identify with when you're younger don't necessarily work so much when you're older, and that's why I've come to appreciate certain singers, lyricists, and hardcore, like like Drew from Time and Pressure, or Brian McTernan on that last Be Well record. One of my favorites, Joe from Wisdom and Chains. He's just smarter with when you read him. And like you said, it's not. I'm 37. I don't want to hear about kicking someone's ass unless it's like. Unless it's like done perfectly, you know what I mean? Like, it's got to be if it's done perfectly, then it's great. But the
I don't need to hear about you and your crew.
Yeah, no, I don't give a shit.
Right.
Yeah. I just mowed my lawn while this thing is in the suburban. Yeah.
Drew from Time and Pressure, man, that dude's giving English and literature lessons in his lyrics.
Yeah,
and I think what's crazy about what he does with that is you can take those lyrics at face value and absolutely love them. But if you get some of the references, like Between the World and Me and Theseus, and like these deep-seated, like, literary and linguistic references, it's only even more impressive that, like, he can present that to you and be like, oh, these are sick lyrics. And then you're like, oh, he's referencing a James Baldwin poem, referencing, an ancient Greek character. It's super impressive.
Well,
and not for nothing, Time and Pressure.
Being a blockhead,
one of the best hardcore bands right now.
Oh, I agree. I think they have one of the best hardcore records that came out this year. But being an idiot like I am, Like, I don't know those references. I know that he's referencing, like, I know that he's referencing something. Like, I'm aware that there's something that he's saying that I'm, and there's good wordplay in there, and I vaguely recognize it. But I just also know on the surface level, it's just better than most things that are being yelled at me in my headphones, you know, lyrically.
Yeah. Dude, 100%, bro.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree more.
And one of the things that brings me to the lyrics is specifically the song False Operative, which I've never read the lyrics for any of the Become One songs. And I can only pick out what I hear. But there seems to be there's something in that song that's, I don't know, just a line or two that, I don't know, makes sense to me in a way that I don't even know if that's what you guys mean, you know?
Sure. What are you thinking?
What's the line about being offended?
You're really offended? Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like, I don't know, I appreciate it, and that there's more to listen to in your band than just the music, because, yeah, you know,
thank you.
Like yourself, having been doing this for quite a long time, it takes a lot more than just some cool riffs to be genuinely invested.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, man. Look, one thing that you and I could probably agree on, having gone to shows for so long, listen, if this was just about the music, hardcore wouldn't be around anymore, right? I mean, we need innovation. We need other things. And you know what's interesting about False Operative is that, you know, it's an interpretive song, but that song for us really sort of came out of the climate on the country in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And just like, you know, it's not necessarily just about a singular group, but just like, you know, for us, it was, you know, when that chorus comes on, and, you know, you're really offended and you just want to be, and like, you know, this idea where it's like, people just get harder, bro. Like, be tougher, man. And I'm not saying that from some knucklehead perspective here, but like, every time you see something on the news or something that you read that you disagree with, that doesn't mean that you need to take to social media and cry about it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, thicken up that skin. You know what
Good.
I mean?
Well, I'm glad I interpreted it the right way, because that's the way I interpret it, and that's the way I feel as well. And we have sorry, I cut you off. I know, but we have, you know,
no worries.
We have kids of certain ages here at my house, 14 and 8, where we have to say these things to them. Like, you cannot like what somebody said, but you cannot let this ruin your day. Like,
no,
people are
man.
Allowed.
That's not worth your energy, man. And like, to me, I think, you know, one of the great things about finding hardcore is, it's like, look, man, we all find hardcore. I think the overarching thing is that everyone who not just finds hardcore but stays in it is because you realize that the general world at large is a complete hellscape. It sucks. It has always sucked. It has very little interest in taking care of us or the people that find themselves in the hardcore scene. But when you're there, it's also not like it should ever be some sort of like echo chamber of the same sentiments. And look, I'm not saying like, you know, let's, you know, that's, I'm not qualifying idiots that are racist or bigots or misogynists. Those people deserve to get their head stomped.
Sure.
But the idea that now people are almost given credibility and gravitas when they're just like, well, I'm offended at this, and I don't even have to think it through. I don't have to know the backstory. I don't have to consider differing or multiple perspectives. I'm just upset, and that's the beginning, middle, end of it. Yo, that's soft. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The world sucks. The world doesn't give a fuck about you. And if that's your stance to so many things, whatever your perspective is, you're not going to do well here.
Right, and I totally agree. And then I always like to back it up, or, you know, saying things like that, back it up with, and by the way, I voted for Joe Biden by mail. So, like, don't act like I'm being some fucking, you know, some fucking conservative ass. Like, you know, just.
Dude, come on. The softest, some of the softest motherfuckers in this country are these idiots that are 1776 cosplaying like this. I'm uber patriot. It's like, bro, you haven't read the first paragraph of the Constitution. You couldn't name the first five amendments. Get away from me. You know what I mean? You're who we're talking about. So yeah, I agree with you on that too, bro.
Nice. Well, I really like this record, and it's only four songs, but did I read correctly? The CD version is more than that.
Yeah. So the CD version, shout out to Nick from New Morality Zine for being the greatest and being down to put it out on his label. We wanted to have something more than just the four songs on the physical format, so we chose four songs from the demo days to sort of fill it out. So it's interesting, like, sort of to bring the conversation back to sort of how you had listened through some of the discography and made that link between Subsidence and those demos. We figured if we have the option, we would put four songs from the demos to give a little context of, like, how the band started to where the band is at. And so, yeah, if you get the physical CD, you'll get eight songs, not just the four from Subsidence.
Nice, nice. Well, and New Morality Zine, the label, as I like to call them, where did that relationship come from?
So Nick and I sort of knew each other from, like, when I was playing in Crime and Stereo, just like casual, chill dude thing. And then when I had started maybe about 6 years ago, started writing for punknews.org and then noecho.net. I forgot how the relationship kicked back up, but I started doing some like features and media stuff for some of the bands that he was putting out, like did some stuff with Life's Question, did some stuff with Time and Pressure. And he and I just like sort of just became like friends through that. Like we would just like, he's also a teacher. And so, like, you know, we'd be teacher nerds and, like, text each other about, like, state testing and, like, what you're reading in the classroom because we're losers like that. but he was just, like, he, you know, it's funny. I haven't seen him in probably 15 years physically.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd been super, super chill for the last few years through me writing up stuff for New Morality and, frankly, really loving what he did. And he actually asked me to write some stuff for New Morality, the zine. And then when Subsidence was done, when those four songs were in the can, you know, I kind of pulled a move on him and was like, listen, bro, any chance whatsoever I could convince you to put this out on New Morality? And, you know, I knew that to me it felt a little icky to do just because I didn't want to put him in a bad spot. But I also personally was like, this is the best thing this band has done, and I would hate for us to just sort of put it out digitally and not have anything attached to it, which would be an even more uphill battle than it is even now trying to get it out there.
Yeah.
And in true, you know, in true Nick fashion, he texted back and was like, bro, let's fucking do this. He didn't even bat an eye at it. He was like, yo, I'm totally down. Here's what I'm thinking. Let's make this happen. And he literally, no joke, I think I texted him at maybe like the third week in June, and he had the CDs at my doorstep before our August record release show. And
wow.
That he made that happen. Yeah, dude. I mean, that dude, truly, he's an angel and the goat, man. I mean, when he says he's going to help you out, it's no fucking lie, so. Yeah, that's how it ended up on New Morality, man. And we really owe Nick a lot for extending that to us.
That's very cool, and that actually answers one of the questions I was going to have for you is how or if the pandemic affected the release of this at all. But it sounds like it got released in in 2 months, so you know. But as far as recording, how did that work?
Yeah, so the pandemic actually did affect us in that it initially slowed it. And then actually sped it up. So, you know, I mean, you're close to the East Coast. You know that, you know, Corona came in generally through New York. So we were locked down first and hardest. You know, I remember.
You guys, you New Yorkers, you always got it. It's always you're the best, right? Nobody did it as good as you guys. Nobody locked down better or harder than New York.
Bro, it's the conceit in New York, man. It's New York or nowhere. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I'll tell you what, the reason I remember it is because the world shut down the week my wife and I moved into our new house. And it was like, we were like, is this really going to fucking happen? And not for nothing. Like, I remember being on the phone with the moving company that was supposed to bring our bed, and they were like, nah, we can't do it. And we're like, we have nothing to fucking sleep on. So when the pandemic hit initially, obviously we went into like super hard lockdown, and then so we didn't practice for like 3 or 4 months. And really all we were doing just to sort of keep the band's morale up is we would have like a weekly Zoom session. Not that we weren't playing instruments or anything, just like, you know, let's just talk shit to each other for an hour every week just so we sort of, you know, remind ourselves that we're in a band.
Yeah.
And then when we sort of got a handle on how to sort of appropriately and safely start meeting up, Ed hit the ground running. Really what happened was, while it's Lotus as a band, he took that time to really round out the four songs. And so once we got back into our practice space, it was like, okay, let's get right in there. And it was great, man. To be honest with you, Subsidence is the first thing that I've actually recorded in 15 years. And we worked with this dude, Evan Perino, who's in a sick Long Island band called Heal, at his little studio. He was great. And it was like a super fun time, man, because it was my first time recording with them, really my first time recording with anyone other than Crime and Stereo in a meaningful way. And we were giddy on these songs just because, like, it's like, as you said, like, these are heavy songs, and we felt that vibe even just in recording.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you earlier, and I forgot to mention it, but you said that these songs were more complex than anything you've done. But you also mentioned bowing out of Crime and Stereo kind of based on your lack of, well, you know, I'll rephrase, your lack of musicianship there. Was it difficult for you to play these songs, or was it just different, or did you get better since the last time?
I think I got more mature. So I think one of the problems with Crime and Stereo was that I was a knuckleheaded hardcore kid that was trying to hide his musical inadequacy by the idea that, like, we're a fucking hardcore band, bro, and we just got to go crazy on stage, and it doesn't really matter how clean the sound is. Really, part of that's true, but the other part of it was that, like, I wasn't doing what I needed to do as a bassist, and that was practicing well and understanding, you know, how to play the bass, not just like, okay, you showed me how to play the song, but I need to understand how to play the bass well. I just sort of, like, you know, having time to myself to mess around with the bass in between the time I left Crime and Stereo and before I got it to Become One, I got a little more technique oriented. And whereas I was a sort of knuckleheaded 20-something-year-old that really didn't want to hear any good advice from the other members of Crime and Stereo, who were much better musicians than me, and I should have taken their advice, by the time I got to Become One, I was much more naturally open to feedback and help and critique. And I think also the relationship I have with Ed, so I've known Ed for 20 years through hardcore, but also Ed and I have trained in Muay Thai for about 15 years together. I've trained with him when he fought. He's trained with me and cornered me when I fought. And so having that dynamic, we literally talk about band practice as though we're going to hit pads in the gym. Like, all right, we're going to skill and drill this tonight. Repetition, repetition, repetition. And so, like, having him mentor me in that sport also translated to him mentoring me into learning how to play a style of hardcore that I really wasn't used to. Just even like things of, like, you know, where, how you're going to change your picking, your strumming method in a certain part in a song, not only to keep the music sounding good, but to sort of preserve your ability to get through the song, and just like small things that Ed was able to guide me through sort of made the difficulty and the complexity of learning the songs interesting, because it was like, I'm literally learning here.
Oh, that's very cool. And it sounds like, I think I find this with a lot of people when they're older in bands, is it sounds like you're enjoying this, your time in Become One, more than you have in any other band. And I don't mean that you didn't have any fun, but it's, but it seems like it's a different sense of enjoyment.
It is, man. It very much is. And it amplifies in a weird way. It sort of amplifies my regrets about my time in Crime and Stereo, because I was a real curmudgeon-y, grumpy idiot when I should have really been a lot more grounded in what the fuck was happening. You know what I mean? Like, you know, doing U.S. tours, doing European tours, you know, kids in, you know, states I've never been to since loving our songs, and me just being like, you know, I expect more out of this. And I think in retrospect, I wasted some of the time that I should have really held a little closer to my heart in Crime and Stereo. And it's sort of easy to romanticize that now, but I do think it's true.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, if I were to sort of quantify my attitude when I was in Crime and Stereo versus my attitude that I'm in Become One, I'm just, dude, to be honest with you, I'm just thankful that I'm still in a fucking hardcore band and playing music at 42. You know what I mean? Like, we're not a big band. You know what I mean? Like, we're not, Become One's not a huge draw on Long Island. We're not a huge draw elsewhere. We're playing New Jersey on Friday for the first time in years, and we'll be in the middle of the lineup, and we're thankful to play it. So it's not like there's any ego involved. I think it's just, yeah, man, I'm 42. I've, you know, made my compromise with having to live in the real world. So it's a blessing to be playing in a hardcore band this late in life.
Well, that's great. And it sounds like, again, that you enjoy it. The product you're putting out, or the product, I think you call it a product, but the songs you're putting out on Substance are awesome. I'm glad you got it on my radar. For the band, even to look back to, it's just a Become One. I don't know. Well, it's been out now for August 6th, I think, was the official release date. How has it been received so far?
It's been, to be honest with you, we can't be happier, because to give you a sense of, you know, how unknown we were, I think we had like 8 monthly listeners on our Spotify before the record came out. And, you know, at the high point about 2 weeks ago, we were up to 400 monthly listeners. Now, we lost a bunch because however the algorithms work or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was – so you sort of have those statistics that make you feel good. But also, you know, just I think it's been well received by people who we value as peers and people who I value as sort of the younger generation that is sort of doing their thing. And to, when it came out, to get like a lot of texts from people that I really hadn't heard from in a long time, saying that they really liked it, and, you know, just sort of going to shows around that time and people being like, you know, it's sick. And not just like, oh, it's sick, but like literally referencing a song and a part where it's like, oh fuck, you actually listen to this.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it meant a lot, you know what I mean? Because, you know, unlike being in a band in your 20s where you have these expectations because you have the time and you have the resources to sort of say, well, fuck it, I'm not going to get a real job and I'm really going to focus on a band. We don't have that. And so our expectations were psyched to get these 4 songs recorded. And then we are super psyched that Nick and New Morality Zine agree to put it out, and then to have positive feedback from our peers and people in other bands and people reaching out. It's been really sort of affirming, where it's like, you know, we're playing music because we're moved to do it, but to know that people appreciate, you know, the product that we've offered, it's fucking sick, man. It's fucking awesome.
Hell yeah, it is. And that's great. I'm glad it's going that well for you. Is there anything... Yeah. Currently on deck? I mean, I know this just came out and you guys are just probably getting back to playing shows, but what's in the near future for Become One?
So we actually have started writing a couple new songs. Not that like we feel any pressure to do that, but you know, it's always nice to sort of be progressing. Right now we're going to, it's weird, like, so with a lot of the restrictions and lockdown stuff lifting, it was like the Wild West with all these bands suddenly reflooding the touring circuit and shows booking up. So we played our record release show in August with Typecast, and it was a resounding success as we looked at it. It was awesome. We sold a bunch of CDs and stuff. We're playing Jersey on Friday. We're playing Brooklyn in October with Crime and Stereo, Koyo, and Hangman, celebrating the 15th anniversary of the Troubled Stateside, which will be kind of cool and meta for me, you know, opening for the band I used to be in.
Yeah.
But those dudes, you know, the Crime and Stereo dudes have put on for us as soon as I got in that band, and I appreciate them with that. In December, my wife and I are having a baby, so we've kind of like put shows on a little bit of pause there, just because like the last thing I need is to be like, oh sick, yeah, let's play Pennsylvania, and then it's like, well, actually you need to get in this fucking car right now because your son's about, you know what I mean, your son's on the way.
Yeah, but it's Punxsutawney, so you know, what would you rather do, Punxsutawney or...
Careful, my wife will hate me because she knows how much I love playing hardcore shows. But so, you know, I think in the new year, Nick and I had talked about maybe we could try to get like a cool little like New Morality zine weekend together, because he's got a bunch of bands now in this area with Standstill on Long Island, Prospect in New Jersey, Broken Vows in Connecticut. So maybe we could do like a cool package weekend, you know, New York, Philly, and Connecticut to do something like that. Maybe get Sunstroke out there on that too. So, you know, I think... we have those shows lined up, and then the new year, it's going to be a lot, as much weekend warrior stuff as we can. I mean, obviously we all have full-time jobs, so we can't do like real deal touring, but you know, we are absolutely resolved to play as much as we can to wherever we can go. That's for sure.
Well, that's great. And I love hearing how excited you are about this. It's pretty cool just to hear that alone.
Thank you.
But I don't know, Mike, I think that about does it for this. We hit the hour mark. You've been awesome.
Heck yeah. Thank you.
Do you feel like we missed anything here?
No, I mean, to be honest with you, you got to put a cap on me, dude, because I'll talk forever about hardcore.
No, okay.
I mean? I'll talk your ear off for hours.
Let's do one last thing. Can you tell people where they can get, if they want a physical copy of the CD, where can they get that at?
Absolutely. So if you go to NewMoralityZine.com and you can go through his online store at Store Envy, you can get it there. You can get it at the New Morality Zine Bandcamp. You can get it through the Become One Bandcamp. And you can get it through the Become One Big Cartel. So it is available. We have merch bundles with some cool T-shirts and stuff like that. And so, you know, I know we're in the digital age where people don't necessarily feel the impulse to buy a physical copy, but if you do like having a physical piece of art in your hands and not just something that you're listening through on technology, you know, we'd love and respect it if you could, you know, spend a few bucks on us.
As they should. I don't know any other way to do it, but I'm staring at shelves and shelves full of records and CDs right now. But yeah, that's
Hell
awesome.
Yeah,
all right, Mike, thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate you.
Dan, thank you so much for having me, bro. I appreciate you for reaching out and being cool enough to have me on the podcast, man. I appreciate what you do.
Absolutely. Thanks, buddy.
So there you have it. That was my conversation with Mike. I want to thank him again for coming on. Easily one of my favorite interviews of the year. The song you just heard was False Operative. We talked a little bit about that. That, of course, is off of Subsidence. You heard how to go get that. Go get that. All right? That's pretty much going to do it for this episode. I want you to go to Instagram at @getting_it_out_podcast and go give that a follow. There's a Facebook page, facebook.com/gettingitoutpodcast. And there is a Patreon, patreon.com/gettingitoutpodcast. Sign up for that if you'd like, though I'm not going to twist your arm. Gettingitout.net really is right around the corner. Currently doing some finishing touches, and I hope you like what you see when it's there. I'm not going to talk about it much anymore until it actually exists. I say that literally every episode for almost 150 episodes, but, you know, eventually I won't be able to anymore, so I got to enjoy it while I can. I'm going to end this one with a song from Torchbearer. They're a hardcore band out of the UK. The song is called Frostbite. They got a video for it. You can find that on YouTube. This is Torchbearer. The song is Frostbite. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye. In my